Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We are so happy to have singer, songwriter, and activist Ani DeFranco back on our show. Ani was on our very first show, our debut. She will go down in All of It history. And now Ani has written her very first book. Her memoir, No Walls and the Recurring Dream, is being released today. It tells a deeply personal story of growth and empowerment that is recognizable across generations. From her childhood in Buffalo, her brilliant but restless mother, to times of homelessness, to working as a caterer, to making her way in the music business that hadn't really seen someone like her before, to founding her own record label, Righteous Babe Records. Ani, welcome back.
Hey, Allison. Nice to be back.
I'm so happy to see you.
Yeah, last time was like your show birthday.
It was my
Now it's my book birthday.
Excellent. Yeah. We'll just keep meeting every six months. This is so interesting. Why right now?
Why right now? I don't know. It's trying to, well, you know what? Truthfully, trying to stay home. Mm-hmm. Got a couple kids at home. My traveling job was weighing heavily on the family systems. So, yeah, trying to devise new ways of making art in the world that don't necessitate driving around constantly.
Yeah, your kids, I think our sons, our children are the same age, and you get to that point where you think, I just kind of need to be around.
Yeah.
It's not even if, I just need to be in their space.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. I need to be in your face more,
exactly.
Don't I? Yeah, it's, and you don't even realize, you know, I mean, the past bunch of years, I would only be on the road, say, 2 out of 12 months, which was way scaled back, yeah, touring from back in the day. But even that amount away, now that I've shifted even more radically and I've just been home for the last 6 months, for instance, last tour I did was September, it really makes a difference in the level of trust and security that your kids can feel, you mm-hmm. know? Yeah.
How did you write? How did you find time? Even because when you get home, you're in demand.
Yeah, well, there's the catch-22s are they come and find you no matter how ingenious you think you're being. Yeah, that was a trick, you know. I mean, they are both in school during the day. So when they were in school, when they're asleep, mm-hmm. behind their back, yeah, yeah.
In your book, you go all the way back to your childhood, mm-hmm. and there's just this great. You have such a great description of your mom. I'm gonna read it because she sounds like she was really ahead of her time. Mm. You write about her. She was part of another lost generation of feminists who slipped through the cracks of history and became victims of their own liberation. She was free to overperform her way into the professional workplace, but she still had to shoulder the bulk of the parenting and housekeeping duties, because no one would conceive of anything different. She martyred herself, my mother, and then one day, in a rage, she quit. She would eventually quit all of us and leave her dream house behind, but those stickers were stuck there on the front door for many years after the words had completely faded away in the weather, and she was long gone. It's a sad paragraph, but it also shows a great deal of admiration for your mom.
Exactly.
As an adult, do you understand what she was going through now?
Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, I think I understood it at the time. Those stickers that are in that paragraph are my mom. I came home from school and she had stuck on the front door of the house, "These premises are no longer under the supervision of the housewife system." And then she detailed all the stuff she would no longer be doing. And yeah, she was the main breadwinner in addition to all of the rest. And yeah, it's just overwhelming. I think women are still, by and large, in that position. You know, you begin to see very recently the paradigm shift opening up where men are actually participating more in the domestic sphere. Mm-hmm. We're beginning to conceive of the idea that men can do that hard work too, and that, you know, the woman can be an active agent in society and the man can hold down the fort. That's the model in my family. But you know, not only is it as hard as the traditional reverse situation, it's hard to swim up the cultural stream, I think, you know? There's, of course, endless support and affirmation for the traditional model and none for flipping the script, you know? So it's still, we're all still a little stuck in the patriarchal systems, are we not? And women, you know, it's like the same, you know, so many generations have to sacrifice themselves to getting out from under these cloaks of patriarchy and racism and, you know, mm-hmm. heterosexism. And, you know, so many of us have to lay our bodies on the tracks.
When you were young, did you feel a new sense of responsibility when your mom left?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was my job to cook suddenly. Yeah. Yeah. And it was a big push towards self-sufficiency and taking over a lot of the work in the house. And yeah, that was useful because soon enough I'd be on my own, and you know, those sort of skills came in handy. So different from now. I have a 12-year-old daughter and she can barely wipe her own butt. You know, I mean, I don't know. I can't understand how in one generation this dynamic shifted so hardcore.
Yeah. My guest is Ani DeFranco. Her new memoir is No Walls and the Recurring Dream. You write about your dad as well. Endurance, another hallmark of my father's life. His family was denied him. His wife would never return. His children would continue to struggle in realms beyond his control. What impact did your dad's struggle have on you and also sort of on your drive?
Well, you know, I think I got really my drive from my mother, mm-hmm. you know, and I really have embodied her energy. And, you know, where do you get your energy? Everybody always asks me. And the shorter answer is mom. Mm-hmm. You know, she taught me her shtick and I, you know, I made it my own. And it took me a lot more decades to really let my father come out of me, mm-hmm. Because he's a very gentle, very quiet. He was an extremely gentle, passive spirit, really. But he was the bearer of unconditional love. And so, mm-hmm. you know, his ingredients in the end are even more essential, I think, to my happiness and my continuing evolution. But my mother's character and force of nature, you know, just dominated for all the years that we were actually together. And now it's like I'm more and more in touch with my father's influence and his guiding light.
You started performing very young, and in the book you make a distinction between your playing and your singing.
Yeah.
That the playing came early, mm-hmm. but sort of your voice came later.
Mm-hmm.
How so? When did it really start to come out?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a bit of a safety with expressing yourself with your hands, you know? There is a level of vicariousness or removal, right? So, but to open up my face and express myself with my voice was not funny, because we're talking about my mother and her empowered, you know, mm-hmm. sort of strong feminist journey. But I was raised, and she was raised, to not say it, you know. You take it on, you feel it, you deal with it internally, and externally you smile, and you're a sweet, nice girl, or else, you know, or else mm-hmm. society just won't. They will recoil from even honesty or you making room for yourself, you know, and that was my experience when I first started using my voice. And I think it just naturally took me a lot longer. The way was further to get to, I don't know, this is how I really sound. This is really my voice freeing itself from my body. I think in the early years of me singing, there's a kind of an urgency, almost a shrillness to a voice that's so desperate to come out. You know, it had that sound. And it took many years for me to just be able to speak and sing. And, you know, because I had made enough room to do that in.
You're originally from Buffalo, and you write a lot about your time not too far from here, like living
that's
in
right.
the meatpacking district and sort of trying to make your way. Of those times, do you recall them fondly? I mean, it was a different New York then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly. I mean, I love New York. I miss the old New York, even though, you know, I mean, I only go back. My tenure in this city was, 89 to 97 or so. And, you know, it's even since then, a lot of change. You know, it's hard to let go of the parts you love as we stay on the planet. But And yeah, those years were incredibly dynamic, you know.
New York was really interesting that decade.
Indeed. I tried to tip my hat to that, you know, the sort of volatile mix of it all, you know, the immigrants and the artists and the freaks and the queers and the street gardens and the chickens running around and just the little dose of anarchy in it all that I just adored.
I can remember coming home from work at like 5 o'clock in the morning down 9th Avenue by 16th Street, which is now Chelsea Market, an Apple store, and there were sex workers up and down and all kinds of shapes, sizes, gender identifying up and down 9th Avenue.
Before it was cool.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was cool, but it was just sort of like, oh, okay, this is what New York is.
Yeah.
At what point, my guess is Ani DiFranco, we're talking about her new memoir, No Walls and the Recurring Dream. At what point was there one, probably wasn't one, but what made you realize, yeah, I have to start my own record label?
Well, I just, you know, I mean, when I was 18, I made a tape, as many, you know, musicians right now are doing all around us, local musicians playing gigs, trying to get their thing going. It's not rocket science to make a cassette, is what I made at that, you know, 88, 89. And, you know, I guess the first thing I did was scribble on it, Righteous Records. It was before the Babe got added in there. And then, you know, it was just sort of my thumbing my nose at the idea of needing a record company. And then I just kind of went with that. You know, I made another recording humbly, borrowing a little money, going into a friend of a friend's, you know, recording directly to DAT tape. And then another, and then another. And then I really started to question. I mean, for me, it was always about getting the next gig. Mm-hmm. And if I had a tape to sell at the gig, even better, that's another sandwich, you know? So I found I was on a sustainable journey early on. And because I was so enamored of just that immediate moment of connecting with people through music, performing, I guess, basically, the sort of the pie in the sky of the record deal and the fame and fortune didn't draw me as strongly as it does some, you know, because I was filling that deep need in me every night without a middleman.
One of the things that you did in your youth, and I thought it was fascinating, the reaction, is you learned the power of image when you shaved your head and how people reacted to you. One, what was in your mind when you said, I'm just going to cut all my hair off? And then describe how people reacted to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, this is, I don't know, 89. And I'm 19. And I'm done being a sex object. Good luck with that, young woman. So I just, you know, I'm playing in bars, you know, mostly populated by dudes with drinks in their hands. And of course, who isn't going to make a play for a 19-year-old woman? So it was not the attention I was looking for. I wanted somebody to listen to my song, you know? I wanted somebody to speak to me as the human that I am. I wanted to be taken seriously as a person and with a purpose. And so I shaved my head. I thought, well, that, you know, and changed my footwear radically. That's another strong symbol of whether, And the result was the Hey Babies stopped, for sure, bam, on a dime. But also something that I didn't foresee happened, and that was that I guess there was just not a lot of cultural context for a chick with a shaved head, a white girl, you know, and I think I was perceived suddenly as a skinhead or some kind of punk that was going to break something or steal something. And everybody everywhere suddenly intimidated, nervous at best, around this 5'2" female, you know, with the goofy smile and the excuse me. And people are, I mean, people cross the street not to walk past me. Nobody asked me for the time anymore. You know, security guards following me around every drugstore I walk. You know, it's just, and it affected me deeply. I got very angry, in a word. And, you know, I talk about it in the book as an experience which, to my poet brain, seemed to have some analogy to what maybe it's like to experience atmospheric prejudice, mm-hmm. in, of the likes of which I can never know. I mean, and I just thought, whoa, who would I be? Let me just check in for a moment. If my skin was five shades darker and this was my life every day, where even the polite people are a little nervous or feel threatened for no reason, mm-hmm. that has to do with your spirit and your countenance and your humanity, how would I deal with that anger? As it built up in me just over the course of whatever, however long I had, a year or two of a shaved head. And it was a moment where I said, okay, take this in, Ani, take this in.
You learned a lot from that experience, though, it sounds like.
Well, from every experience,
yeah.
Good and bad.
Good and bad. Yeah. And there are many of them in here. I wish we had more time. We only got up to about this far.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what? It's a good, people have a good sense of how introspective you are in this book. The name of it is No Walls and the Reoccurring Dream, a memoir by Ani DeFranco. Ani, so, thanks for coming by.
Hey, thanks for having me again. So cool to see Nick Hornby, too. What a wonderful serendipitous.
It was a pretty good day around here.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Ani DeFranco, No Walls and the Reoccurring Dream. This is All of It on WNYC.